On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so. And the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now." What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory. And his disciples believed in him. After this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and brothers and his disciples. There they stayed for a few days. And ending at verse 12, the Lord will bless his truth to all our hearts. For Christ's sake, we ask it. Amen. As I said a moment or two ago, of all the stories of miracles performed by Jesus during the course of his earthly ministry, none is more well known than the one John puts first in his gospel, the story of the turning of water into wine. And that story is not only one that everyone loves for whatever reason, but also has come to mean or signify much more than just the story itself. In the movie entitled The Gospel Road, which Johnny Cash filmed and released in 1973, at one point when he comes to the part of the story where he tells about the changing of the water into wine, he says this. He says, "The miracle of the turning of the water into wine is a parable of Jesus' teaching in itself, an act of kindness, of love, and of charity for his friends and neighbors." And that, at first reading, is how it seems. Jesus goes to a wedding feast. There's a major family disaster. So Jesus meets the need of the moment. And we all see that. And it's such a human situation. Because Jesus and six of his disciples probably turn up at a wedding feast at which his mum is already present. It may have been someone in her family, because she seems so personally involved with what happens when things go wrong. The wine runs out. Maybe the bridegroom's family didn't calculate correctly for the guest list. Or maybe the fact that Jesus turned up with six of his followers halfway through the feast didn't help matters. But for whatever reason, the wine ran out. Jesus, after what seems like some initial reluctance, gets the servants to refill six jars whose contents were normally used for ceremonial washing with about 180 gallons of water. When they draw the water out and take it to the tables, the water is wine. The best wine that they have tasted in the whole of the feast. That's the story. Now for me, that story, which John highlights as the first of the signs of Jesus' ministry, okay? That story is for me a truly inconvenient story. Because in the Christian community in which I grew up and where I was nurtured, the wonder of what Jesus did was recognized okay. This was a miracle. Because in the world in which you and I live, in no known earthly circumstances does water spontaneously turn into wine. Only the power of God could do it. And so in the church family and background in which I grew up, all of that was recognized, but my Christian community didn't drink. Well, I don't mean we didn't drink. I mean we didn't drink anything that had alcohol in it, okay? And it was generally thought that alcohol and the drinking of alcohol was something completely worldly and something that Christians didn't do. And if you drank before you became a Christian, you gave it up as soon as you got saved. And so for me, the truth is, I can't see what the big deal is about wine. I might have had a glass of wine 5 times in my entire life, and quite frankly, I couldn't care less whether I ever have another one. Why couldn't Jesus just have made slur from the water? Now, in the community in which I grew up, because that was the attitude to alcoholic drink, okay, all sorts of explanations and excuses were ruled out for Jesus' behavior, because it is an inconvenient truth that if you believe that Christians shouldn't really drink anything alcoholic, that our Savior made stuff that was alcoholic and people enjoy drinking it at a wedding. So how do we explain that? Well, lots of reasons were offered. Wine, for example, was an antiseptic and disinfectant in an age in which no water supply was purified. You'd be safer drinking the wine than drinking the water. And also people would have said that wine in Jesus' day was in itself not as strongly alcoholic as it would be today, and that would be true. Furthermore, wine was never drunk neat, but was always mixed at table, 2 parts wine to 3 parts water mostly, thus reducing its potency even further. And all sorts of true things about the situation were often rolled out to say, well, Jesus made wine, but really it wasn't that bad. Still, of all the things that Jesus might have chosen to do in his very first sign, was making wine the best choice he could have made? And yet, of this sign, John says, what Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory. We have to come to terms with this miracle because this miracle is an epiphany. And that's where we are in our season at the moment. We've walked through waiting and arrival, and we've come to revelation, to the season of epiphany, to the season in which we are thinking about how God began to reveal and manifest to the world who Jesus really was. And John tells us that this miracle, the miracle of turning the water into wine, was one of the ways by which the revelation of who Jesus was took place. This is an epiphany. We've already observed the epiphany for the Magi, star, and the epiphany for the Son of God himself in the pleasure of the Father and in the presence of the Spirit. But in this event, in Cana of Galilee, 4 to 8 miles from Nazareth, where Jesus grew up, not quite sure the exact distance, because there are 2 different villages that this might have been. Okay, so depending which one of the two it is, it was just 4 or 8 miles from what had been home for Jesus for most of his life. In this event in Cana was an epiphany for another group of people. We've seen an epiphany for the Magi, and then we've seen an epiphany for Jesus himself. Here's an epiphany for another group of people, because John continues these words that we've already read by saying, and his disciples believed in him. This is an epiphany for disciples. I want to think about that epiphany this evening for a moment or two. I want to think, first of all, about the epiphany which was experienced. The testimony of the scriptures is universally consistent. The lifelong, intimate, faithful companionship of 2 human beings in marriage is something of which the Lord approves and something which the Lord blesses. And every culture has its own way of celebrating this union. Lots of things we do today weren't done in Jesus' day. But whatever it was they did, the norms of Jesus' culture at the weddings of his generation, Jesus was happy to be involved with. Not only does he go along, but he takes some of his disciples along with him, probably six from what we know of what John previously says in the verses before this. And Jesus and his disciples joined in the festivities. Now, think about this for a moment, because I'm guessing probably everybody in church here has been to a wedding at some stage, your own or somebody else's or somebody in your family circle. Excuse me, or a friend at work, you've been to a wedding, okay? Now, if you think about going to a wedding, the Jesus that we sometimes imagine would have cut a very sorry figure at a wedding. You know? He would have been just like you look when you end up at a wedding you don't really want to go to. You know, you get an invitation and you're thinking to yourself, what can I possibly have to do on that day that would get me out of this? Or if I don't go to this wedding, is it going to give so much offense that it would be better for me to go than not go? And so you end up going, but to be honest, you're miserable. You don't know very many people there. None of them are really your friends. You don't really like the meal. The wedding itself has been completely boring, and you're totally like a fish out of water. And quite honestly, everybody else wishes you would go home because you're spoiling the occasion. And the way we sometimes think about Jesus, that's exactly the kind of figure Jesus would have cut at a wedding. And yet the amazing thing is, instead, the Jesus that we see at this wedding, you can kind of see him here congratulating the young couple. One ancient tradition about this story, which is not in the scripture, and I'm not quoting this, is factually true, but one ancient tradition says that this was the wedding of the disciple John, which is why it's in his gospel and no one else's. And John was Mary, Jesus' mother's nephew. Now, there's no empirical evidence for that, but if it was John's wedding, you can imagine why this might have been a wedding that Jesus would show up at. And you can imagine him congratulating the young couple. You can maybe imagine him making a speech after the meal if they were stupid enough to throw the floor open for anybody to say something. And it would have been a really good speech. You can imagine Jesus dancing with some of the guests, chatting with some of his relatives and neighbors, eating the food and, yes, drinking the wine. And I challenge you, at the next wedding you go to, imagine that Jesus is one of the guests. Look around you and pick someone out. And imagine that that person is Jesus at the wedding. Because Jesus doesn't have a problem with joy. The way we talk about him, the way we paint him sometimes, you'd think he did. But Jesus was at this wedding. He enjoyed being at this wedding because he doesn't have a problem with the joy that is occasioned by human happiness and blessing. I think I may have said before that the greatest example of pure joy that I think I've ever seen in my life was my daughter Esther on the morning of her wedding. It's the only way I can describe the look that was in her face when we stepped in the car in Dalewood and were driven down the road towards the church. And her face looked like that throughout the whole of the rest of the day. It was just pure joy. And Jesus doesn't have a problem with human joy. Let's not miss that before we go on to talk about what this miracle is actually about. However, the hospitality disaster which occurred could well have put paid to all that. All the joy, all the celebration, all the fun that was going on could well have been destroyed when the wine ran out. Instead of that hospitality disaster ruining the wedding, it became a moment of opportunity for epiphany. Jesus turned water into wine. But here's the thing. The epiphany wasn't for those who knew what Jesus did. When the water was drawn out and had been taken to the master of ceremonies, we read these words. It says, the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. The servants knew exactly what had happened. They knew what Jesus had done. But there is no indication in the story that though they knew what Jesus had done, that they saw the glory. For them, there was no epiphany. Only the disciples experienced the epiphany. How come? Well, I think what really happened here was that the servants saw what we see when we watch a magician produce a dove out of a handkerchief. When you see that happen on the television or perhaps on a live show, I remember for one of our children's birthdays, they wanted to have a magician, and we brought a magician along, and the magician produced a small white bird out of his hand. And my reaction being there that day, just like your reaction, was, how did he do it? I didn't think for one moment that he spontaneously created a white bird inside his closed hands. I knew he had concealed the bird somewhere. I just couldn't figure out where he had concealed it and how he got it from wherever he had concealed it into his hand to make it appear like it had just materialized there. Nobody looks at a magician and believes that what they see is actually what's taking place. And none of the servants who carried the water from the watering jars and poured it out on the table and saw that it was wine believed for one moment that they had just witnessed the Son of God turn water into wine. You see, miracles do not convert the world. What was almost certainly the greatest miracle that Jesus did, a miracle which was seen by many, many people, including key representatives of the leadership of the Jewish nation who had made the short trip from Jerusalem to Bethany. When Jesus stood beside the tomb of his friend Lazarus and asked him to take the stone away and called out in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out, and the crowd watched a dead man walk out of a tomb. You would imagine that immediately people would have said, wow, who have we got among us who can do that? Which was not what happened at all. What actually happened after that miracle was that the miracle sealed Jesus' fate. So from that day on, John says in chapter 11, verse 53, from that day on, they plotted to take his life. They saw no glory at all. Just a dangerous charlatan. And the miracle of turning the water into wine was no different. Even the servants who drew the water and poured it out as wine saw no glory. Can you imagine the conversation with the bridegroom afterwards, you know? Because the bridegroom, he doesn't know anything about this. He's busy being the bridegroom, okay? And the master of the feast calls him over and he wonders, well, what's wrong? And the master of the feast says, oh, you're some boy, you. He said, why, what's wrong? Well, he said, everybody else give people the good wine at the start when they're still sober and they can taste what they're drinking. And then they bring out the cheap wine at the end when nobody can taste anything anymore, but not you. No, you kept the best wine till the end of the feast. That's amazing. And you can see the bridegroom kind of looking around at the servants to think, what's your man talking about? We didn't have any expensive wine. I thought we were serving the cheap wine. Where'd you get the wine from? You can kind of imagine the conversation because he doesn't know what has been happening behind the scenes. And how much more amazing would this be if that person actually was John, Jesus' disciple, trying to think, what in the name of the world just happened there? Of course, whoever it was, whether it was John or another bridegroom, they're very polite and very humble and thank the master of the feast. Yeah, well, we thought it'd be a good idea. You know, my bride and I sat down and thought, well, this would be a really good idea. And I've made it some excuse around it, and that was that. And when he gets the servants on their own a few minutes, where'd you get the wine from? And they said, well, you're going to love this. It's actually water out of those big six stone jars over there. But apparently everybody thinks it's wine. And if John was the bridegroom that day, one of the disciples, when he heard that story, he saw glory. He saw glory. Nobody else did. Everybody else was trying to figure out how they did it. But the disciples knew that this was not that, that something incredible had happened. Because you see, epiphany starts with a change in your heart. If you're going to find out who Jesus really is, miracles will never convince you. It always starts with a change of heart. Do you notice something about the Gospels? There are no accidental miracles. It's not like as if, you know, Jesus carries around, you know, and there's a power about him where he goes and it just zaps people. And if you happen to be within zapping range, okay, and you've got a problem in your health or a problem with something else, you know, it just gets mended because you kind of came within the zone of the power. There are no miracles like that anywhere in the New Testament. Every single person that Jesus healed had to come to Jesus. They had to want it, and they had to testify about what happened. Because the key point about all these miracles was not the power of Jesus to do it. The power of Jesus was available. It was the heart attitude of the person that sought the healing, that sought the miracle. The father who came on behalf of his child. The blind man who had never seen from birth. The sisters of a dear, dear brother who had suffered and unbearable bereavement. They all had to come to Jesus. They had to ask for help. They had to, from their heart, receive what God was giving. There is no epiphany in miracles unless there is a heart to see. You see, we have it all wrong with miracles. We have this idea that miracles are necessary for those outside the church to believe. No, miracles are necessary for those inside the church to believe. The epiphany that day when the water changed into wine was not for the servants who drew the water, but for the disciples whose hearts were already being changed. We need miracles. We need to see the hand of God at work, because only we can see in ways that the rest of the world can't. A number of years ago, I went to Royal Victoria Hospital to pray for a child who was dangerously ill, and the child was healed. A child is still alive today. She's a teenager now. The child's parents, who saw what happened, didn't go to church before it happened and didn't go to church after it happened. And it made no perceivable difference in their lives, the fact that their daughter was truly and completely healed made no observable difference to them. But it was totally a special moment for me. Because I know what happened that day. I felt it when it happened. And throughout the years, I look back on it as a moment of confirmation that healing ministry is genuinely something that God calls the church to in this century in which we live. Made no observable impact other than gratitude and joy that their child was well, on the couple whose child it was, but it made a massive impact on me. That day in Cana of Galilee, there were a load of people at the wedding and none of them saw the glory. The only people who did were the disciples. Miracles are for the church, and we need to see them happen if we are to be sustained and encouraged in our faith. If you stop praying for God to do something dramatic among us, please start again. Please look for it. Because epiphanies through miracle are experienced by those whose hearts are already changed. So there is here an epiphany that is experienced, but there's also an epiphany that is facilitated. There are few stories in the New Testament in which Mary makes any appearance at all, and none in which she plays a more vital part than this one. It would appear that the disgrace of Mary's earlier years has long since fallen off her life. She was an invited guest at a family wedding. And not only an invited guest, but someone who now obviously commanded the respect of those who were there. You can see it in the way the story unfolds. Perhaps she was involved, as capable family members often are, in helping to organize the details of the hospitality at the wedding party. Everybody knew that maybe Mary was a good baker or a good cook or a good whatever, and so let's get Mary involved. Furthermore, Mary was used to doing things on a budget. She had a family to raise potentially without her husband. And so she'd be ideal for a wider family with little money wanting to put on the best show they could for the newlyweds. For whatever reason, Mary was intimately involved and had the respect of the family. So much so that when the wine runs out, who is it who takes an initiative about it? Mary. She goes to Jesus. We read, when the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." Now, when you read this story, the bit that comes next, Jesus' reply to his mother, in any English translation, seems exceptionally rude and petulant. And the reason for that is that it's almost impossible to translate into English what, what Jesus says. The idioms of his speech don't directly translate, or our culture of parent-child relationships is not the same. We could get close to what actually Jesus said here if we heard him saying something like this: "Mom, what do you want me to do about it?" Okay, I remember one day my mom, when she was still alive, rang me up from her home in Ballymena and said to me, "Son, the door that lets you get from the rear of the property round to the front is stuck, and I can't get my bin down to the gate." And I thought, well, Mum, what do you want me to do about it? Like, I'm in Belfast and you're in Ballymena. Right, okay. So later that day, I trundled down to Ballymena and with my toolkit in the boot of the car, eventually got the door freed. But quite honestly, the door was toast. It was rotten and it was completely swollen and so on. But I got it open. We got the bin out and that was that. But I when my mum rang me, you know, much less I love my mum and trying to do things for her, I had like about 25 other things I needed to do that day. Trekking down to Ballymena to fix a door at the side of her house was definitely not top of my series of priorities. And I maybe felt, "Mum, what do you want me to do?" And it was kind of like that that Jesus responds. Well, so there's no wine. So what do you want me to do? Jesus was working to a timetable, and he was not going to be rushed. He says to her, "Look, Mom, what do you want me to do? You know that it's not my time yet. The time for God to reveal his glory through me hasn't come yet. That's a bit further down the road." That ultimate epiphany was still some distance away, and every other minor epiphany on the way was not Jesus randomly to choose. He was on a program. He was following the instructions of his father. He had to wait until he knew what the father wanted him to do. But Mary was a resourceful woman. And she went on ahead anyway. His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." She knew that he would do something. The point is, Mary had absolutely no idea what Jesus was going to do. And I could be pretty much 100% certain that Mary did definitely not expect Jesus to fill 6 water jars with water and turn the water into wine. I don't know what she thought he would do, whether she thought he had some contacts or friends who could help out, or whether it was something else that would happen, but she certainly did not expect what happened. But by this stage, Jesus had been around the house for 30 years and no one knew him better than Mary. And she had a sense that this was his moment. She couldn't say why. So as soon as she heard that the wine had run out, she thought, this is a moment for Jesus. And that's why she went to him. You know what she did? It was almost like one of those parents that phone up the Michael McIntyre television program and suggest that their daughter or son or some relative of theirs should become the unexpected star of the show. Seen the program? Okay. And so some poor, you know, unsuspecting individual goes to what they think is the theater or a museum or something else, and they end up on the stage with Michael McIntyre, and they're going to sing a solo with Michael Ball or somebody else at the end of the show, all right? And the parents do this because they think, well, my son or daughter, like, they would never apply for this themselves, but I think they're really good, so I'm going to set them up. That's almost what Mary was doing here. It's almost like Mary knew that it was her son's time. She knew that he was radically different from all her other children, from all the other people she'd ever met. She knew about the promises. She had been with the angel when the angel told her what was going to happen to her. And she had this sense that somehow or another, this was a moment for Jesus. So she pushes him up on the stage. She put him up there for the epiphany. Can you imagine the aftermath? It says, after this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and brothers and his disciples. There they stayed for a few days. What do you think they talked about on the road down to Capernaum? And what do you think they talked about over the next couple of days? And I can kind of imagine them going down the road and everybody's talking about what Jesus did and Mary staying very quiet in the background thinking, I wonder if he's still cross with me. I believe Mary anticipated this moment. I think Mary sensed that somehow or another a moment of time had come in which the glory of Jesus could be revealed. And she took a massive step of faith and she set it up. Have you ever felt like that? I remember a long time ago, I'd been on the Alpha Course, you know the story. First person in my life I ever knowingly led to Jesus Christ. Sitting in the car with my best friend from school, on the way home from a Christian concert, somebody I'd been praying for months before this, and had seen some signs that maybe he was beginning to open up to what I believed Jesus could do in his life, but there was nothing more definite than that. And sitting in the car, and just as I'd got about to get out of the car, he asks me a serious question. And I remember thinking to myself, this is the moment. This is the moment. This is the moment of the answer to the prayer. This is the moment of epiphany. I'm thinking the next thing I say is the most important thing I've ever said in our friendship. And sure enough, that night David came to faith in Christ, changed his life, sent him on a trajectory of Christian influence that continues to this day. But I had a sense in that moment that this was one of those moments, a moment of revelation, manifestation of the glory of God's Son. And I had the opportunity to put Jesus up on stage. We are called as disciples of Jesus to experience epiphany. It's right that we should ask the Lord to move powerfully among us in miracle. We need to see the hand of God at work. but we are also given the opportunity to facilitate Epiphany. Because we seek to live close to Jesus like Mary had for 30 years, nobody knew him better than she did. And in this moment, she had a sense that this was Jesus' moment. And when we live close to him and cultivate our relationship with him and become aware of his voice speaking and breathing into us and through us, we become sensitive to those moments when it is our job to put Jesus up on stage and let him do what only he can do. Epiphanies, something we need to experience that we might be confirmed in our faith and renewed in our following of Christ, but they are also something that we are called to facilitate in conversations, in chance meetings, and opportunities that come and people and friendships that we have been in for years and years and years, and we've been waiting for this moment. When the moment comes, we make sure we don't miss it. I'm going to invite the band to come. They're going to play a song. You can listen while they play. You can hum along quietly or just listen quietly if you like. And after they finish this song, I'm going to give you an opportunity to respond. To respond to the call to Epiphany. To become those who recognize that God is at work and see those moments and use them for his glory.